Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Adrian C. Neely. Adrian is a research scholar at the Jonathan Edwards Centre at Yale University, but he's also director of the doctoral programme and professor of historical theology at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids. We're really pleased to have Adrian on the show today. He's here to talk about his new book, just published, called Before Jonathan Edwards, Sources of New England Theology, just released by Oxford University Press earlier this month. Adrian, congratulations on the book. It looks fantastic. And thanks for coming on to the show.
Thank you, Crawford, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's great. It's great to have you. It's a fascinating book, isn't it? Because in some ways, it's doing something that no one has ever attempted before, which is to take the in expanding, really rapidly expanding body of research about post-Reformation Protestant dogmatics and tracing that as it moves across the Atlantic through a number of thinkers and ultimately into the life, thought, theology and career of Jonathan Edwards. What's the background to this book, Adrian? How did you come up with such a compelling and challenging idea?
Before Edwards, I seek to balance the, I would say, the recent academic attention to the developments and intellectual history after Jonathan Edwards. On the one hand, I think the recent rise of Edwards scholarship and, say, eminent reflections on Edwards' uniqueness in American religious history, his, say, Puritan sermon style and substance, and the appropriation of his thought in the courses of New England theology, gave me to pause to offer another study on the preacher and theologian and philosopher of Northampton. And on the other hand, the rise of another scholarship at the same time, that of Protestant scholasticism and the Reformed Orthodoxy of the early modern era, rarely coincides, in my opinion, with studies on Edwards. But together, I think it offers considerations to reassess and to reinterpret Edwards' theological relationship to the early modern era. In particular, I would say the publication of Oliver Crisp and Doug Sweeney with the title After Jonathan Edwards, the Courses of New England Theology, which study was lauded as a groundbreaking study of a neglected topic. In fact, that book became a further stimulus to embark on a more comprehensive study on providing a broader background of Edwards' use of Reformed Orthodox and Protestant scholastic sources in the context of the challenges of his time. And to make a modest attempt, an initial attempt, to show long-standing trajectories of classical Christian theology that I think are indispensable to discern continuities and discontinuities of Edwards' theological thought.
Now, to move from the sublime to the ridiculous, You end the book with a quote from Aaron Sorkin's West Wing: "Some good things are not from New England." And the funny thing about that quotation is, of course, that in the West Wing, Jonathan Edwards' own Bible plays this very important role in one inauguration ceremony. Why are we still interested in Jonathan Edwards? Why is Jonathan Edwards the kind of 18th century philosopher, theologian, preacher, revivalist, church organiser, administrator, who still commands public attention, as that West Wing episode indicates? Why is he important?
I think it is for various reasons. I would list, say, two or three. The first, I think the big push of historical theology over, say, the last 25 years have given many students and now scholars of historical theology a drive to give attention to primary sources. But particularly in an American context, we start to see over the last, say, 25 years, almost no attention to the Latin sources. People tend to aim for primary sources written in English. And so on, in an American context, but also I think on a global context, an international context, there where Latin is not taught in schools or considered even in graduate studies, students like to do research on, say, English primary sources. And so Edwards is one of those candidates to explore, because over the last 25 years, his corpus has become so widely available, particularly when we launched the digital edition in 2008 at Yale University. We started to see a real global interest of the reading of Edwards, and I have to say, particular of his sermons. So not just scholars, but also pastors and preachers are reading his material. On the other hand, we see people from, say, with reformed theological inclinations, or people with, say, more charismatic inclination, find in Edwards a articulation of matters of faith intellectually and with piety. And this combination seemed to attract people to Edwards and give rise, I think, on the attention and scholarship of Edwards, what we see right now around the world.
Now, you mentioned primary sources, Adrian. I don't think I've ever seen a book with such full footnotes. And if readers want to see what footnotes can do, this book is worth looking at just in terms of the architecture of the page, because the footnotes represent an extraordinary amount of primary source research. It's really quite amazing. And I suppose what you're doing with those incredibly full footnotes is drawing our attention to this vast and not quite, but almost totally unexplored theological hinterland for Edwards in post-Reformation Reformed dogmatic writing in Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about what that body of literature is, and also how we have begun to think about it through the work of Richard Muller, Willem van Asselt, and others?
Now, first of all, I'm really pleased and thankful that the editor Cynthia Reid of Oxford University Press allowed me to keep the Latin and the primary sources of the, say, primarily 17th century, leave them as it is and have them in the book, and not being driven by, you know, what you see by many publishers nowadays. It has to be translated, it has to be simplified, and a really toned down version, which was really my appeal to Oxford University Press. Please, can I leave those sources in? Because I think, on the one hand, I want to show this is the big, broad background of Edward's intellectual world. And at the same time, dit is dus de, as far as I am concerned, the trajectory of Christian theology through the ages. And a third point is to consider those sources as Edward did, what we call now maybe a kind of ressourcement or a kind of a retrieval theology, going back to the patristic, going back to the medieval sources, going back to the, in this case, the 17th century early modern reformed theology, that Edward is using, so being historically informed, but wants to be contemporarily relevant in his own time.
So there is this massive body of writing that Edwards interacts with, and some of the writings that he is interested in, that others in his New England world are interested in, some of these writings are read intensively. You've got a wonderful remark somewhere in the book where you describe one of the New England theologians reading one of Maastricht's works seven times. It draws attention to this figure of Van Maastricht. Of course, this is someone you've written about before, but in this book, before Jonathan Edwards, Maastricht becomes a really central figure, doesn't he, representing the achievements of this post-Reformation Reformed dogmatics world. Can you tell us a little bit about Maastricht, your previous work on him, and perhaps why he was significant for Edwards and other New England theologians?
Well, that is maybe, and I have to be honest in that, I think that is on the one hand the strength and at the same time maybe the weakness of the book. The reason that I picked Maastricht is not because I did my doctoral work on Maastricht as kind of a forgotten, I think, important theologian. I mean, he is a codifier. He is not an innovator. He is a codifier. But in Maastricht comes together, I think, the whole architecture of Reformed theology, early modern Reformed theology, particularly in the 17th century, with four aspects: exegesis, doctrine, polemic, and practica. And those four components, I mean, yes, you have devotional works, say, in the English Puritanism. You have dogmatics works in the 17th century on the content. The output is astonishing of systematic theology. Yes, you have exegetical works like Matthew Paul and others on the continent on biblical interpretation. But it is Maastricht who brings those four disciplines together in his systematic theology, the Theoretica Practica Theologica, and shows thus the long-standing understanding in Christian theology that biblical exegesis, biblical interpretation, is the basis for the formulation of doctrine and the formulation of practice. It is completely intertwined. It is related. They are not standalone enterprises. The reflection of scripture give rise to the formulation of doctrine and give direction of the practice of theology in the Christian life, but arising out of scripture. And I think Maastricht is very, very strong on that by showing that in his Theoretica Practica Theologica. And that was, I think, acknowledged in New England as still the prevailing architecture of doing theology. And I think with the rise of the Enlightenment, the rise of the changes in the universities in Europe in the 18th century, mid-18th century, and later, that you get specializations, systematic theology department, biblical department, practical theology. In New England in the time of Edwards, I think it was still understood that doing theology, those four components are integral, related, and important of doing theology. And I think the many pastors, when I show that, for example, a lot of auction catalogs after Auction Kettle of Ministers. I mean, throughout New England, Maastricht was known. This was kind of your go-to book to consult on theological matters, but you had at your disposal the exegetical foundation, the doctrinal formulation, if there were polemical issues to be considered, it was right there. And then, of course, the practical implication of the exegesis and the doctrinal formulation. It is all present in Maastricht.
Mm. So this is a community of theologians who believe that ideas have consequences, don't they? And one of the things that you show Maastricht as being interested in is the issue of slavery. Can you talk us through this issue of slavery, why it was important perhaps in a European context, but crucially, how New England theologians began to think about this issue using Maastricht and his peers as a kind of resource?
Yeah, you have to consider, particular if you consider the history of the Dutch Republic, that in the 1730s, 1740s in the Dutch Republic, there was almost a full discussion going on about slavery. Historically, the boats from Africa arrived in places like Middelburg, Amsterdam, other towns, sometimes with slaves, sometimes without slaves. But as I mentioned, for example, Bernardus Smijtergeld in a catechism sermon on stealing addresses very vividly, in very vivid language, the issue of slavery, noting, I mean, you have to be aware that that in front of his audience from the pulpit were the captains of the boats, the business people that run the boats from Africa to the Dutch Republic. So that is one very vivid example against the use of slavery. At the other hand, you have people like Jacobus Elisa that are entering in the University of Leiden, originates from Ghana, is trained as a Dutch pastor, returns to Ghana, what is called now Ghana, and was actually defending slavery. But I want to show, while in the Dutch Republic there was almost a full discussion going on, I think there was a kind of an awakening taking place in New England. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, I would consider Edwards as a transitional figure. While having himself slaves, his immediate successors like Samuel Hopkins, his own son Jonathan Edwards Jr., are becoming now known in scholarship as one of the first advocates against slavery in the colonies and what became America, but that discussion takes place later than in the Dutch Republic. And I think if you read the disputations of Voetjes, particular, mm-hmm. they were very well aware of this issue. Maastricht is part and parcel of that, I say, intellectual context of the slavery discussion.
So you show us in the book very, very clearly and persuasively two very different theological contexts. The context of late 17th, very early 18th century Europe, the context of New England in the same broad period coming into the rise of Edwards and his pastoral career. You describe Maastricht as Edwards' theologian of choice. Why do you do that?
I think in critical points in his life. I mean, he's using Maastricht throughout his life, from about 1725 onwards, when he received the book, to a couple of months before his death. He's continuing to make use of Edward. But on very strategic, I would say, for Edward's doctrines, like his reflections on the covenant, he's very particular and selective, making use of Maastricht, whereby I think for Edwards, Maastricht is representative, has a more comp. I mean, let me give a comparison. If he makes use of Maastricht and Turton is another favorite theologian that Edwards is using. But he uses Turton for a specific reason, only for, say, polemic theology, as the genre of Turton's eclectic theology, of course, is. But Maastricht is the whole enterprise of theology. When Edwards refers to Maastricht, it is always as representative thought, so kind of, if I say now, or if I direct the reader to Maastricht, this is representative of my thought on the issue. So I think in that way he used Maastricht as a resource, as a source to confirm and to articulate his own thinking on that issue.
So in some ways he sees Maastricht then as representative of this broader tradition that he would like to place himself within. But does Edwards also disagree with Maastricht at points?
Yeah, that is a good question. I have wrestled with that for a long time, because I think Edwards as a theologian should not be confused, as I propose, with, say, the professional theologian of the 17th century teaching at a university, teaching theology, being a systematics, church history, or biblical studies. I think we should not confuse that. I mean, Edwards is not of the same stature as a theologian.
That's quite a controversial thing to say, isn't it, Adrian?
Well, look, I mean, the portrait that I arrived in the book of Edwards, that I am saying it should not be confused as the theologian like the 17th century, not like the philosopher. I really have a problem, and I have to be careful, but I do not consider Edwards as a philosopher in the sense of the classical understanding, like a John Locke. Or, I mean, Maastricht was a philosopher. I mean, he wrote in his time anti-Cartesian works. He had degrees in philosophy as well as theology. It is not a Heereboord. So Edwards is responding to its time as a, I think, first and foremost, as a pastor, seeing the rise of Arminianism in New England, seeing the rise of deism, and he is concerned about his congregants. So how do I respond to that? And I think he is doing that as a private scholar, not as a trained philosopher, not as a trained theologian in the classical sense, that wrote a full-fledged systematic theology. I think by when I read Maastricht over the last more than 10 years, I sometimes have the feeling I'm listening to an unfinished symphony.
Mm. So there are some differences then between Maastricht, the world, the intellectual world he represents, and Edwards in his quite isolated and relatively bookless New England study, but you show us in the chapters in this book that there are some very important links between them, and you identify a number of big themes: preaching, exegesis, doctrine, and then finally history and eschatology as a way to measure Maastricht in particular, Maastricht's interest or influence upon Edwards. If we take preaching, first of all, Edwards is obviously the most famous preacher in American history, but where is he drawing his homiletical style from? Is the European context important for that?
Look, as I lay out, I think that is not an unknown assessment of Edwards as a, say, Puritan preacher or Puritan style. My aim of chapter two is to show that the identification of Edwards' preaching or Edwards' sermons with only the Puritan style of preaching, plain style of preaching, should be reconsidered. Knowing that many of the, say, classical handbooks of homiletics, being it the very important work of Erasmus, of Augustine, going back to Augustine, the Doctrina Christiana, part 4, many homiletic handbooks of the 17th century were present in New England, were known in New England, and the Theoretica Practica of Maastricht that Edwards used included the so-called best method of preaching by Maastricht. So when we consider those sources together with, say, the sources of Puritanism on preaching, particular in this case that I deal with is William Perkins' work, The Art of Prophesying, I think we start to see that he is not just a slavish follower of so-called Puritan preacher, but that the trajectory of Christian homiletics comes together in Edwards, but drawing not exclusively from the Puritan tradition, but is fully aware on matters of rhetoric and oratory and other aspects that are well known on the continent and well known in the history of Christian homiletics. And I just propose maybe a small, but an correction of getting away from, oh, Edwards is the Puritan preacher. I think there is more than that.
One of the chapters that I think struck me most powerfully was chapter 5, which is a chapter about history and eschatology. And in particular, you put Maastricht Edwards there in conversation with the dispute between Coxeus and Vutius. Could you just talk us briefly through that dispute, how it impacts upon Maastricht, how he negotiates his way through it, actually, and then how that plays out for Edwards in terms of his massive but unfinished history of redemption?
Now, if you refer to the Coxein Fuchsian debate, particularly on the doctrine of the covenant, older scholarship on Maastricht identified Maastricht almost exclusively as a Fuchsian. My reading is somewhat different. I think not only he was a colleague of Witsius at the time when Witsius served at the University of Utrecht, the architecture and considerations that Maastricht gives to the development or the, say, the development of his formulating of the doctrine of the covenant has very strong Coxean notions. Yes, there are differences, the very technical things on the aphesis and the ephesis of Coxeus take. Maastricht is much more restrained, Witsius is restrained, but it does not mean that they ignore the contribution of Coxeus. And it is Maastricht particular, which Witsius, to my knowledge, never have said, it is Maastricht when he reviews the debate in his church history, that Maastricht says this debate was unnecessary. And also his whole upbringing was in a very strong Coxean context. So he was well aware of it. Yes, he was a student of Vucic, but on his formulation of the doctrine of the covenant, I think there is this seeking a middle way or connecting the Vucic
approach.
The future formulation of the Doctrine of the Covenant and Coxane binds them, or at least makes an attempt to bring them together. Mm. So with that in mind, we start to see that Maastricht is not what you would expect in a reformed systematic theology of the 17th century with the six loci. That the sixth loci is the doctrine of the last things on eschatology. No, Maastricht is laying out on the dispensations of the covenant of grace from Adam to his own time. And in my humble opinion, despite a lot of ink has been spilled in scholarship about a history of the work of redemption of Edwards, I think in terms of architecture of the whole product of Edwards, and on very pivotal point, I think he must have considered Maastricht to a very great extent. Not John Owen. It has been suggested in scholarship that John Owen might have been appropriated by Edwards for his history of the work of redemption project. I don't think so.
Some people would say that might have made it a better book, Adrian. It's such an important book. It's such an important book because it says so many new things about post-Reformation Reformed dogmatics, including Owen, and so many new things about Edwards and the way in which he and his New England colleagues received and used that legacy. It really does set two quite distinct research agendas, doesn't it, for us to look again at the achievements of the European post-Reformation world, but also the achievements of Edwards and his reception of that world. What kind of impact do you hope this book will make?
Time will tell, but I hope that early modern Reformed theology, say post-Reformation Reformed theology, will be more considered as a transatlantic enterprise. Not restricted to the continent, not restricted to Scotland or England, not restricted to the continent and the British Isles, but as a true transatlantic enterprise. I just have discussed in this book on the connection of the continent, primarily the continent, and the New England and the British colony of New England. Much more work, for example, I'm working right now on the middle colonies and Brazil. We have troves of archives in Brazil of the 17th century, where ministers that were trained by Maastricht and during the time of Maastricht and Vucic were serving in northeast Brazil. And we have those archives, so much more research needs to be done to really make this a transatlantic project. So that's the first. The second thing I hope that people realize that when we study a certain discipline like post-Reformation studies or Edwards studies, that we have to have, or at least we and our students have this deep awareness that at times there is a very strong connection between two seemingly different scholarships that are going on. Mm-hmm. But but look more for an interdisciplinary approach. And I think that hopefully will help us to be better historically, and in this case, better historically informed. And if for preachers of today, that they are informed in such a way to articulate Christian theology in a contemporary relevant way. That is my hope.
Well, I'm sure the book's going to make a massive contribution to that end, and I really look forward to reading your work on Brazil when that comes out as well. But for now, Adrian, I'm conscious I've taken up a lot of your time today. It's been wonderful to have you on the show. You've written an extraordinary book, Before Jonathan Edwards, Sources of New England Theology, just published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Thank you for your time, and thank you for coming on to the show today.
Thank you for having me, and wishing you well. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone else for listening in. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.